Cowabunga, and welcome to Hidden Behind the Music Stand. I'm your host, Patty Ryan, and with me is Catherine Otis, who is currently pursuing an artistic diploma in cello performance at Rice University and concertizes in the Houston area, as well as Chicago and New York City. She also is a content creator on her Instagram page, Girl Meets Cello, and we'll be talking about recreational running. Welcome, Catherine. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Patty. I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah, it's been a while, too. So, we know each other. I was just realizing that you've done all your education at Rice, which is kind of amazing. how many people can say that? So clearly I met you because we were in the same studio for a time with Norman Fisher. And I just remember entering as a master's student. I think you were a undergrad. I can't remember what year though. Definitely I think at least a junior or something like that.
I think that's right.
Upperclassman. And just being blown away by what you were playing. And I was like, oh my God, if she's doing that, then what am I doing here? I mean, a kid, because I think I have something to say. But yeah, I mean, just it was just fantastic watching you and just always so awe-inspiring of just the high caliber playing and technique that you have. It's just so solid.
Thank you.
And also, yeah, and all the fun tail pieces, I feel like you went through a little bit too.
Yeah, I did.
I mean, Mr. Fisher's studio was kind of known as the tailpiece studio or the end piece studio too. But yeah, so that's how we know each other. So Kathy, what's your most insane performance story?
It's kind of a funny story. Basically, as you know, I have a twin sister, Jacqueline. And so she plays the violin. Yeah, shout out. She plays the violin and we just kind of had a running joke, and this will probably always happen, but whenever we are at each other's performances, when one person is wearing a dress, fancy attire or something, the other person is more casually dressed because they're in the audience, without fail, every time someone comes up to either my sister or myself, the person who didn't perform, and always congratulates us, oh my gosh, how wonderful, we really enjoyed it. And we just kind of stand there and smile and say, thank you. Yeah. So you kind of just get used to it. The first time it happened to me, I was really taken aback. I was no, it's not me. But yeah, it's just become a running joke between us because it's just a lot of fun. I think it's kind of unusual. Not a lot of people have that happen to them.
Yeah, I'm sure I've been one of those people too. But
yeah, I mean, it's always in a complimentary way. And it's just just funny. I it doesn't bother us. It just, it's very funny. And it's kind of nice to be oh, thank you. I did a nice job. Yeah, just sitting here.
So. Yeah. I mean, have you ever done any kind of pranks on anyone by being, identical twins?
Not really growing up. I mean, we tried once to trick my parents and that didn't work.
Yeah,
and then after that, we weren't good at carrying it off. One time in high school, we tried to switch instruments and pretend that we were the other person, but I cannot play the violin at all.
Yeah.
So, she can't play the cello. It was awful. Within 30 seconds, the teacher was like, what are you doing? We never successfully did anything. Unfortunately, I would have liked to have some kind of shenanigans, but we did not.
Yeah. Violin and cello technique are just too different to make that really work. Yeah. Is Jackie still at Rice as well?
She's not. She's actually at Peabody now. Doing a graduate diploma.
So now it's because there was a time, of course, when the both of you were at Rice. So actually now it's it's probably sad that you're distant, but it kind of gives you a little bit more of a cushion to, I guess, I don't know, not be compared to all the time or something.
Yeah, it's definitely been a little bit weird because we are so close, and like you were saying, we did undergrad and master's together, but it's also been really nice to just kind of, be by myself and, have kind of my own identity. Even though I've always been very independent, I think, you naturally get grouped together as a twin with someone else. So it's really nice to, people can confidently say, hi, Kathy, and not be like, oh shoot, is this the right person?
Yeah,
it's good.
Yeah. Are you ready for some spitfire questions?
I'm ready.
Okay. Mahler or Bruckner?
Mahler.
Debussy or Ravel?
Debussy.
Cats or dogs?
Oh, dogs for sure.
Okay. Appetizer or dessert?
Probably dessert. I love anything dark chocolate.
Ooh, yeah. Solid. Same. Sparkling or still water?
Still.
Fan favorite question, alternate universe musical instrument.
Ooh, this isn't really an instrument, but I would have loved to be a pop singer where I could dance, be Ariana Grande or something.
Sure. Okay. I feel like there's always that appeal, at least in some ways, being a classical musician or soloist, especially when you're younger and starting out and playing all the hard concertos and stuff like that for the first time. Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. I think that'd be fun. I also love to dance. So
sure.
Just get to do that on stage would be great.
Yeah. I wonder if there was a way to like merge your cello playing and be a pop singer at the same time, like Lizzo or something.
Yeah, that would be pretty crazy. I don't know. I think that I would get like pretty bad stage fright, but like in my imagination, it seems like an amazing experience.
Oh, totally. Yeah, totally. Early bird or night owl?
I've kind of alternated. I'd say I prefer getting up early after I'm awake. I can be super productive, but I do not wake up early naturally. So it's always a struggle. But once I'm up, I'm like, oh, I'm so glad I did this. Yeah. Okay.
Pandemic guilty pleasure?
Probably baking. Sounds cliche because like everyone said, you know, there was the phase of the banana bread. But yeah, I mean, I love to bake. And every day my sister and I were living together during lockdown at the very beginning. So we'd like go on walks and then at night we would do puzzles and bake cookies or banana bread or something. So
that sounds like a great way of doing lockdown.
Yeah. It was entertaining for a while, for sure.
Yeah. Okay. Favorite professor shout out?
I would like to shout out my two teachers at Rice, Mr. Fisher and Mr. Smith. They've both been so influential in my life, and I just owe them so much.
Yeah. Definitely Rice is chocked full of great cello pedagogues. Yeah. And
you can't choose one. There's so many.
Most inspired musical hero of any genre?
Anderson East, I don't even know what kind of genre he is. It's like alternative indie R&B maybe? I don't know.
I guess I'm not familiar.
He has so many combinations of instruments and like the sound is really good. His voice is amazing. It's very relaxing to listen to, but also like there's just so much like soul and like passion in it.
Is it really layered music as well? Like there's a lot of little details within it or is it?
Yeah, there's.
Not like Jacob Collier, but like.
Yeah, yeah. There's a ton of different instruments. Like there's piano, saxophone. Sometimes there was like a flute, guitar, drums. And he just like has like this like sultry like voice. Mm. It has such a personality. Like if you heard it, you know, like, oh, I like that like personality that you can hear in his songs.
Wow. Okay. I'll definitely check him out.
Yeah. Yeah. You should.
Most transformative performance experience?
I would say the first time that I felt really comfortable playing Rococo. That's probably the concerto that I've played the most with orchestra. Mm-hmm. And there was one time where I just felt very comfortable with the piece. So I wasn't worried about any of the technique or anything like that.
Right.
And I remember, I think it was in the sixth variation, which has always been like my favorite. And I just felt like I had a lot of freedom and I just like did a different slide up to a high note. And I just felt like the time was kind of suspended. Mm-hmm. And it was just like this magical feeling of like, I can like have like artistic creativity almost. Like I could create or experiment with anything, which I don't usually like to do in a performance. But it was just this very cool feeling of complete freedom. And like, oh, the audience is just like watching me. Like I can try anything right now. And I just felt like, yeah, it was just this very cool feeling. And I felt that a few times, but I got to be like really comfortable with the piece so that I can just relax and go for it instead of, you know, being worried about anything. It was really cool. I try and do that more now.
Yeah. I mean, to me, that sounds like it's like being out of control, but within control at the same time. Because as you say, you could rely on yourself to take a chance on something that in the past you might not have because you're a little bit concerned or maybe I don't want to impose my thoughts of what you were thinking, but maybe you were cautious or trying to play, make sure that it was just stable to begin with. Right. Mm-hmm. So it was like this moment of like, there's a little bit of give in that control, but then you were still. Yeah. A master of that moment at the same time.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of like pushing the boundary, but not too far. So things totally fall off the rails.
Right.
But you know, you're just outside of your comfort zone. I think that's where like growth and it really works. Happens.
Yeah. I think that's the most rewarding part is when that works.
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. Desert island piece of any genre?
Probably the most interesting piece I've ever played is Prokofiev Symphonia Concertante. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's so many different layers and interesting things in that. And I love that piece so much. So I feel like I could spend so much time just keep working on it.
I mean, I have to admit, like, out of all the pieces I've heard you play, your version of that piece is stuck and lodged in my brain forever.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I love it. It's so much fun.
I mean, I know there was a point I think you're preparing for the concerto competition at Rice with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I think you were performing it a lot in general, but I just remember, again, being swept away and being like, oh my God, how is she doing any of this pyrotechnics right now? But like, it was always so clean, so solid, so musical. So yeah, I'm just like, well, that's the definitive version of this piece in my brain is Kathy's version.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I wish that I could go back and learn it again for the first time.
Like for the first time. Yeah.
Yeah. It's always good to go back to things and redo them. But there's something special mm-hmm. about like the first time you play it, you know?
Totally. Well, you finished the Spitfire questions. Congratulations. You made it.
Thank you.
Yay. Right? Did I get it?
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay, Catherine, can you walk me through your musical origin story? How did you discover music? When did you find the cello? How did you choose the instrument? When did you decide that you wanted to pursue it professionally? And all the steps to where you are today.
Okay, so neither of my parents are professional musicians.
Wow.
But
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, yeah. My mom does play the bassoon, but she's a doctor. So I guess, as I've been told, when I was about 2.5, my sister and I were watching PBS. It was some kind of concert, maybe the New York Phil or something. And we were just watching, and I guess I said, oh, I want to play an instrument. And I just pointed when the cello was on the string, like, oh, I want to do that. And my sister, like, saw the violin, and she's like, oh, I want to do that. And so my parents, you know, kind of were like, oh, well, that's funny. Haha, you're only 2.5. So, you know, kids will say kind of crazy stuff all the time. So, like, maybe when you're 3, like, we can talk about it or whatever.
Right.
And apparently on my 3rd birthday, I went to them and I said, okay, I'm 3. I'm ready to start playing.
I'm on a time schedule now.
Yeah, I was like ready to go. So they couldn't find, we lived in Austin at the time. We couldn't find anyone. Yeah, Texas.
Okay.
Couldn't find anyone who would teach me the cello, and we couldn't find a small enough cello. So my parents just didn't know anything, and they're like, oh, well, she can start on the violin, and then when she's a little bigger, she'll just naturally switch to the cello.
Sure, right.
So I started actually playing on the violin when I was probably about 3.5, and I did not like the violin. I was, I don't know what, it just, you know.
It's too squeaky.
Yeah, it was terrible. And so when I was 4, they were able to find a small enough cello. I think it was like an 1/8 or something.
Oh, so that's so cute to think
about. And I would sit on a little stool with some phone books in my kitchen. And I think I played like 5 minutes a day. So, you know, I wasn't like doing anything, but I would take, you know, a little lesson. And my mom actually started learning the cello with me.
Oh, sure.
We did the Suzuki, and they quickly realized that the violin was not the same as the cello. So I stopped playing the violin.
Yeah.
And then once I was big enough, I started playing the cello. Yeah. So that's how I started. Basically, when I was 4, my family moved to Boise, Idaho. And that is where I met the most amazing cello teacher. His name was William Wharton, and he would drive down 6 hours every weekend to teach cello students in Boise. He lived up in Moscow, Idaho, which is where like the University of Idaho is. He was a cello professor there. And he would drive down every weekend to teach. I think he had like 25 or 30 students in Boise. And so I started taking lessons with him, and I did Suzuki for a while. And then I started playing just, you know, normal repertoire and stuff like that. And he was just the kindest, most generous man, an amazing teacher. So I did that until
I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm just personally curious. I mean, Boise is a big city. Like, is there not, or he was just like the best that you could get?
Boise is now growing to be a very good sized city. But at that time, when I was younger, it wasn't really that big. We naturally just found him. It's not like we sought him out. It was just, you know, someone was like, he taught at the local music store.
Okay. So it just, it was almost like destiny or something that you guys met.
Yeah. I mean, you know, one day we were just asking around and they're like, oh, well, this guy teaches here. And so we just, you know, I mean, I wasn't very good, and it was just for fun, you know?
Sure.
So my parents weren't trying to find anyone like crazy, but it just worked out really well. So I studied with him for about 10 years. I went to a music festival in Durango, Colorado called Music in the Mountains. It was about 3 weeks long, and it was founded by this man named Arkady Fomin. He was violinist in the Dallas Symphony. And we just went there for fun because my family has friends in the area. And we met them, and he basically talked to my parents and suggested that we need to find, especially for my sister, like he wanted to teach her personally.
I see.
Yeah. And he had a friend who was also at the festival, whose name was Jesus Castro Balbi, who taught at TCU at the time. So
could you say it again?
Oh, Texas Christian University. It's in Fort Worth. And then Mr. Foman lived in Dallas. And so when I was about 14, my parents decided that once a month we would go to the Dallas area for lessons.
Wow. Okay.
So I did that for 3 years.
And so then, once a month you would have, in the meantime, you would have lessons with your like regular teacher in Idaho, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So it was like supplemental lessons on top of normal lessons.
Yeah. And then after about a year, I started going just to Dr. Castro Balbi at mm-hmm. TCU. Because, you know, it's hard to have, you know, too many perspectives when you're so young.
Yeah.
And so we felt that it was the best to pursue that path.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, about every month or every 6 weeks, I would fly in, take lessons for 4 or 5 hours
mm-hmm.
on Saturday, and then fly back home on Sunday. So it was like a pretty rigorous schedule when I was there, and it pretty intense. And like, I had to just really focus for that time. And I mean, it definitely was not as ideal as, you know, having a weekly lesson that's kind of spaced out, but I think it taught me to practice, you know, on my own a lot. I was so fortunate.
You must have really known how to be efficient with your time at an earlier age than most people mm-hmm. like me. I didn't know what I was doing.
I think it was a lot of trial and error, and I definitely didn't practice anywhere near as much as I do now. I did maybe like 2 hours a day.
Yeah, okay.
Maybe two and a half before I went to mm-hmm. college. So yeah, I was just very fortunate that my family was very supportive, and you know, we talked about like, is this something you want to do professionally? Because if not, you know, we're not going to go to these extensive measures to try and get you like the best possible education you can. So at that time I had decided like, okay, I want to give this a shot. You know, I was like, I can always do something later on, but I can't come back to this. So like, I want to see this through.
That's how I felt too.
So I just, yeah, I did that for a couple of years, and then I applied to Rice, and I was very adamant about going to a university and not a conservatory because I really wanted the college experience. Like all of my friends and, you know, my family has always been non-musicians. And so I wanted to be able to make friends and take classes that weren't in music. I mean, I had friends at the music school, of course, but it's just nice to be able to have a conversation with someone who, you know, is a political science major or a med student. Because like, there's so much to learn in this world. And I feel like the more like broad exposure you have, especially when you're young, is really good. And yeah, I mean, I loved my undergrad experience at Rice. I got to take so many cool classes, a lot of psychology, a lot of Spanish. And of course, the music program is like unbelievable.
Yeah.
So I'd say then I started just getting more serious for sure and practicing more. I had a few moments where I was like, I thought about, oh, should I switch? You know, should I do a different major or something?
Mm-hmm.
But by my junior year, I like had decided this is what I meant to do. This is what I love doing. I'd had a couple of performances where I felt like, you know, this is something that's really special that I can contribute to the world. And there's been so much effort and thought and time on everyone's part, my family, my teachers, myself, that I was just going to go full in and commit 100% because otherwise it's very hard to be successful.
Yeah, it's one of those, this is definitely a profession where you can tailor it to whatever you want it to be, but to really be quickly successful, it takes a huge commitment to do so.
Definitely. I think so. I totally agree. And when you don't have a schedule of like, okay, I have to do this project that's due now, or I have to do this class or whatever, you have to create your own system, you know, and you have to hold yourself accountable for the time that you practice or don't practice.
Right.
Because like, no one's going to be like, oh, well, you could have practiced today. Like if you want to be successful, you have to have that internal motivation.
Inner drive.
Yeah. And I think that obviously that comes and goes for everyone. But for me, I was decided like I was going to do it and went on that path. So,
okay. What did music and the cello become part of your identity? You know, a defining characteristic of what makes you you and unique?
That's a good question. That's hard. I mean, I feel like I've always been very drawn to music. Like when I was 6, I was really into writing songs, and like, and one time we were in the grocery store and I just started like humming a song and like making up words. And so my mom like wrote down, and I like still remember it to this day. It was called like In My Dreams or something.
Oh,
you know, like, very like, ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm always humming. My boyfriend is always saying like, what what are you singing? What are you doing? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I'm always dancing or humming or moving around. There's always like some kind of music in my head, which like sounds really weird. But
similar.
So music has always definitely been a part of me. I personally feel like cello is the best instrument in the world. And anyone who thinks differently just is wrong, in my opinion. So yeah, I don't know. I feel like the cello kind of chose me a little bit and I chose it. And I just feel like it fits really well with my personality. It's like you can kind of be a little bit like a star sometimes with the melody. Sometimes like you're the bass, mm-hmm. you're like the backup, you know, mm-hmm. kind of get mm-hmm. a little bit of everything.
Yeah, it's very versatile.
It's very versatile. You know, there are definitely times when I'm like, man, I wish I didn't play the cello. Like when I have to fly on a plane, when I'm like, why couldn't I play something little that fits in the overhead compartment?
Yeah, totally.
But I mean, I definitely would never want to give it up now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a tricky line, I think, when you're talking about like identity, because obviously like I am a cellist. I love the cello and all that stuff. But I think it's like, I think I try and draw a careful line between like, you know, how my playing is and like how I value myself, you know, like self-worth and stuff, stuff like that. Because I think it's really easy to blur that line. And then once that happens, then you're really kind of walking a tightrope on how you're going to, you know, do well.
Yeah, it's
great. Not well, not great.
Yeah, though that's a really great perspective on mental health when it comes to musicians. And as you're saying, like identifying your identity within music. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think we all cross over or blur that line occasionally as well. But
definitely.
Yeah, but like it takes, again, a bit of practice to separate or like find that balance. Yeah. So thanks for bringing that up. Another question I wanted to ask. So, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, but it seems like throughout your pursuit of learning and mastering this instrument, you've chosen a path that's more or less on the soloist competition-based side of the spectrum versus like someone like me who pursued chamber music, someone like, I don't know, an orchestral cellist pursuing an orchestral job. Why was that the direction you went? And how is that unique or different than maybe some more of the other ways that people pursue a career in music?
I think I became interested in more of the solo career when I was younger because it's what I was exposed to. You know, I got to perform. My first performance with orchestra was Allegro Passionato by Saint-Saëns.
Oh, you know, so cute.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So cute. I remember I was 11 and I was so excited and it was like so much fun. And it was this community orchestra up in Boise. And I was like, this is great. I would love to do this like more.
Yeah.
You
know, it's a great feeling. Yeah.
And when you're a kid, you don't really think about all of the other aspects of the way things work. You know, you don't think about lifestyle. You don't think about finance. You don't think about how competitive the field is, you know, or like, would you get burnt out? Or everything is just sunshine and rainbows when you're like 11 and you're like, this is amazing. I love this so much.
Or
so
anyway, like, I was going to chime in and say, I also feel like there's a lot of opportunities for young musicians who are... I don't want to use the word prodigy, but are definitely ahead of the curve as compared to someone like me who started at 9 and was like trying to figure something out, you know, but yeah, there's a lot more opportunities and like it's almost given sometimes. Is that too, I don't know, is that right or wrong?
I think it depends on the circumstance for sure, but I definitely agree with you. The more advanced someone is and the younger they are, the better that is for marketing, for whatever, because everyone wants to see the latest and greatest youngest person that can do this.
Right.
And I think that's true in any field. It's true in sports. It's true in whatever. So yes, I do agree with you. I think that there weren't a lot of cellists around my age too in Boise, you know, and as I, you know, started going to different festivals and I was exposed to more things, I still always really liked to perform either in recitals or doing like a movement of a concerto or a full concerto or something. And so I just did that and I'm naturally a very competitive person. Like I like to win, which I think a lot of people do. I like to be the best at anything that I do, which I'm not by any means the best, you know, at a lot of things, cello, like whatever else in the world, but I strive to be the best that I can be. And so for me, having things like a competition that is like a goal that I can push myself towards, I've kind of come to the realization that the lifestyle of being a soloist is not necessarily what I have in line with my vision of what would be ideal. So I'm currently just taking orchestra auditions. I would love to be in an orchestra. Ideally, I think I would like to see myself have some kind of title position eventually, mm-hmm. just because I like being a leader. I like interacting with my colleagues. And I think it would just be a wonderful experience. I love playing orchestral works. The sound that you can get with like an entire orchestra versus just one person, I think is incredible. So I think that kind of presents the opportunity to do the best of both worlds in a way. You know, you can still do performing on the side, you know, mm-hmm. and do a lot of solo performing and chamber music and all that stuff. And then you also have the orchestral side of things. So it's kind of just the best of everything.
Yeah. And also it's a very stable job. I mean, minus a pandemic, but yeah, generally speaking, it's a very stable job. So it's like, yeah, it's encompassing all the best of everything in music that is possible.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's an update I wasn't aware of. So thank you for sharing that. Yeah. Can you briefly tell me about Girl Meets Cello?
Sure. Okay. So I started Girl Meets Cello at the beginning of the pandemic. I think it was like May 2020, mid-May or something. And I had been kind of considering making an Instagram page for a while. I'd seen a lot of people do it. And I was like, you know, that's a really great way to get your name out there. It's a good way to hold yourself accountable for, you know, practicing and standards of how you want to be playing. Honestly, recording stuff and listening to it helps me practice and play better as a musician. And so it kind of just started out as a fun project. And I wasn't sure exactly how, like what direction I wanted to take it in when I first started. I was thinking at the time that maybe I would do like kind of more of like a holistic life balance perspective where I was like, maybe I'll make up recipes and put those on or like fun workouts or stuff like that, or like, you know, different ways to spend your time in lockdown. You know, it was like, but over time I decided that I wanted to focus mostly on cello. And so I've mostly just used it as a way to kind of figure out for myself, like, okay, how can I keep playing these pieces? How can I learn new things? And I also think it's been really helpful in terms of like getting some concerts. I've like met a lot of students on there, which I love teaching and doing that. I did a lot of virtual concerts, like more early on in the pandemic. Sure. But yeah, it's definitely grown into a much bigger thing than I was anticipating when I started it, because it was just kind of like a fun project. Well, so I really like that. I feel like I've connected with people, like a lot of different cellists, musicians, non-musicians, whatever, from all over the world, which is really cool. And I think like social media is really a great tool that we have. Like, I think it has a lot of positives. It can have some negatives as well. But I think that if, you know, we use it in a positive way, and, you know, if this is a way that someone who doesn't have access to classical music then can look on their phone and say, oh, like, I've never heard anything like this before. Or, like, I've never heard someone play the cello or violin or piano or whatever. And they get exposed to classical music, you know, when they're young. Like, I think that's amazing. You know, it kind of takes the equation of like, oh, I have to pay for an expensive ticket to go to a concert. You know, it's just like accessible. And so, you know, I've done a few different things. Like, sometimes I'll like post practice tips because I'm like, maybe someone can, you know, this will help someone when they're practicing. Or this last summer I decided I wanted to create an online course for how to like be productive when you practice, so that I did that. And I have like a bit of an entrepreneurial like mindset. I've always been like really interested in business, like thought about going into like, oh, maybe one day I'll open a bakery or, you know, something just like totally random.
Let me know. So I'll bake with you.
Yeah, that's kind of how it started, and it's really interesting. I really enjoy seeing so many other amazing musicians and wonderful people and talking with them. And so, yeah. It's
been fun. I obviously follow. And it's also girl.meets.cello, just to clarify for people who want to follow. So I clearly follow your account. And I love all the content you create. I think it's fantastic. So everyone go follow if you haven't started following girl.meets.cello. So what are some upcoming projects you have lined up for you?
So I have several different projects that I'm working on right now. The biggest one that I'm really excited to share is actually going to be with a nonprofit that my sister started in 2020. It's called Classical Karma, spelled C-A-R-M-A, and it's concerts aiming to raise money and awareness. And so the organization is based in Houston. It's a nonprofit, and we're going to be partnering with different organizations in the Houston or Texas area and doing doing benefit concerts to secure funds for them.
And awesome.
Stuff like that. So in August is going to be our launch concert, and I'll be posting like all the details on my Instagram, and it's going to be really a fun concert, and we're going to be raising money for our first season, where we're going to be working with an organization in Houston called Search, which is an organization that helps the homeless community. They aim to end homelessness in Houston and rehouse people and just give them a lot of hope. So we're going to be doing a bunch of free concerts for them and raising money for them. So that's like something that's really big that I'm very, very excited and passionate about, because I think it's so important to give classical music to anyone. So yeah, keep an eye out for that in August and probably a little bit in the summer months as well. I have a few other projects that are going to be coming up in the summer and fall in terms of like recording stuff and some like new like special things, but I don't want to talk about them just yet.
Okay. All right. So just keep posted and tune. Again, follow and subscribe to, I'm assuming you'll post everything on girl.music.
Yeah. Post everything. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Are you ready to take a break?
Yes.
Okay. We'll be right back. Welcome back from the break. So I've always known you as well while we were at Rice together that you were an avid runner.
Yes.
How did you get into running? And I also love running too, but...
Oh, yeah. No way. That's awesome.
But I'm not as like active as you are with it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I started running my senior year of high school, and I did my first 5K in September. I guess that would have been... 2013 or something. So it was a while ago, almost 10 years now. When I first got to Rice, you know, we have the great 3-mile loop that goes around campus.
Yeah.
And so every Tuesday and Thursday, I would run the loop like one time. So it'd be 3 miles. I'd do it twice a week. I felt really good about myself. I was like, I'm running so many miles. Like I'm so fast.
Yeah.
I wasn't fast at all.
Yeah.
I was not fast.
Yeah.
But you know, it was fun. So I got into running, and then very quickly I made like my best girlfriends that I'm still friends with to this day. They were all on the track and cross country team at Rice.
Okay.
And so I saw them running all the time, and I was like, well, I want to join. And so sometimes I'd run with them on the weekends, on like Sundays. I'd do some of their long run with them. And it quickly just became like something I wanted to do in terms of fitness. I mean, I've always been like a little bit more active. Like I did a bunch of bar classes in high school at the Y, and I would do like Zumba, but nothing like super serious. But then when I got into running, I liked the competitive aspect of it, of course, you know, that you're really racing against yourself, you know,
right,
trying to get new PR. And so then I really got into like more longer distance running. So I trained for my first half marathon, probably my sophomore year. It was the summer after freshman year. And I've had a lot of injuries from running, mostly I think just because I started running too much too soon. And, you know,
that's my problem always too. I feel like that's always my rookie mistake. And I feel like every time I start running, I can't stop. I'm just so eager to like get going and like be like fast and like perfect. So I always get like injure myself somehow within the first like week or two. That's definitely me.
And it's taken me a long time to learn there's a balance, and like I can walk a little bit and then run a little bit, you know, as I'm like getting back into it. But I didn't really realize that for a long time. And I definitely I had a stress fracture in like my senior year, but I decided like a lot of strength and rehab. And
I kind of remember that actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's been some setbacks. Okay.
Yeah, I remember like you were hobbling a little bit, right?
Yeah, there was always like something. So I've kind of moved past that phase, hopefully. And I run probably four or five times a week now. And I'd love to run a marathon one day, but for now I'm scared to do that kind of distance. So I'm just like,
why?
I'm worried about getting injured.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And also I'm like, I don't know that I want to take the time, you know, to do those long 20-mile training runs and stuff. I love the half marathon and the 10K the best, because they're like long enough that you don't have to feel like you're dying the whole time, but it's still very strategic in like how fast you want to run each mile. And so I'm kind of just going for some PRs and trying to get like faster. I've been doing a lot of strength training, which I think is also really important as a musician, you know, to keep your upper body really strong too. And like core and stuff like that. I also do yoga. Just like, you know, anyway, even walking, like something to get outside. I love waking up early if I'm going to go for a run, you know, when the sun's like just kind of coming up and it's like kind of like golden outside. There's just something like really magical about like, even though you're like really tired and you're like, oh, why am I doing this? Then like, as soon as you start going, it's just very peaceful. And it just like feels really good to just kind of like, you know, wake up with like the running endorphins and whatever. And then the rest of my day is always always like so much more productive and it feels great because I had a great start to the day. Yeah.
I have a lot of questions.
Okay.
I can learn a lot from you too. Okay. So one question is just very silly for me because of my past experience running around Rice. How did you not trip and fall around the campus?
That's a very good question.
So for people who don't know, like, yes, there is the loop around Rice University, which is a really great 3-mile run, but the pavement and sidewalks are just rickety, crickety. Like, it's just not flat. I've personally fell at least twice, if not more, and like really significantly scraped my knees really badly and like reopened something. It's just really gross and really painful. And like, I was I think I told this story once on Tim McDuff's episode, but like there was one time I fell while running with him around the loop and like I really scraped my knee so badly that there was just blood trickling all down my shin. And I walked to the closest, I think it was like the student center or something like that. I walked to the closest place and Jacob Schaefer, like shout out to Jacob, but like he like saw me and was just like horror on his face of like, what happened to you? It was just really funny. Anyway, so how did you like not trip around Rice?
I have taken a couple of tumbles myself, but actually, okay. I have to say, in the last couple of years, it's so much better. They have put in a lot of fresh dirt. It's smooth. There's no roots.
Thank God.
There's no roots to trip on. The concrete doesn't like come up off the trail. It's like very continuous, so it's very nice.
Now. Okay, well, it's good to know that they fixed that.
Yes. Yeah.
So, what's your average mileage you run, and what's the longest you've run?
The longest I run is probably
half marathon.
Yeah, half marathon. So probably like 14 or 15. miles, like in training for that.
Yeah.
On average, I probably run about 6 miles
a day or
whenever I run. Yeah. Unless I'm like training for something where I'll have like one long run a week where I might build up to like 12 or 13 miles. But yeah, I'd say on average, like 5-6 miles is usually pretty good.
Yeah. So here's now my big question. How do you train to run longer distances?
That's a good question. Well, I think everyone has something that works for them. For me, it's just you build up super slowly. So, you know, you start with your base. For example, for me, if I'm starting at 6 miles and say like over the course of 6 weeks, I want to go to 12 miles. So like I'll only run a longer distance once a week, say on Saturday. So I'll start off with 6 miles. Then if that feels good, maybe the next week I'll do 7 miles. So I'm like adding 1 mile.
Okay.
Then I might stay at 7 miles for a week. Then maybe the next week I'll do 8 miles, so on and so forth till eventually I reach 12 miles. Like what people do that I have kind of like learned about is that everyone tends to do way too much, way too fast. Kind of like with anything. I mean, this is how people get injured in music and stuff too. It's like they go from doing nothing for like 1 hour, then they're like, I'm gonna practice for 5 hours. Or like you go from running 2 miles and you're like, I'm gonna run 10 miles, you know? And like, if your body's just not ready, it hasn't built up the endurance and the strength that it needs for that, then you're gonna get injured. And also the other thing I would say is definitely don't be afraid to take walking breaks. I mean, like,
see, that's always my fear.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like, you know, walk every half mile for like 2 minutes, you know? I mean, it might increase the time that you're out, you know, or it's gonna be like slow, but really the times that matter are like the races that you do, you know, like your training runs. Like you can, if you want to take a walking break, or you know, maybe something's starting to like get a little tight or sore, or, you know, you're tired or whatever. Like I think people think when they walk that they're not like real runners, and I don't think that's a thing.
Yeah that's definitely a stigma I've associated, and like I feel like I'm almost a failure if I start walking. Like, oh man, my, like I'm just so out of shape or et cetera, et cetera. Like yeah so I like more times than not will push myself to keep running, which I'm learning that that's like a huge error to do.
Yeah.
That's probably why I get injured.
Yeah. No, I like usually will take a break every mile or two just to like even just stretch or anything.
Sure.
Just to like loosen up anything. And but yeah, if you mix in walking breaks and stretch breaks, and you know, I mean, depending on how long you're running, like maybe you need water or something, you know, then I think it's like pretty doable. It's just you can't do too much too soon.
Okay. Do you have any devices or apps that you use, like a Fitbit or I don't know,
Apple
I'm
Watch
a
big
or something?
Garmin girl. I have the Garmin Forerunner style watch. I got it. Well, I got this one my senior year of college. The one I currently have. I have the 645. But I would strongly recommend a GPS watch. I mean, there's a ton of different models out there, but I like love the Garmin one. It tells me like what I want to know about how fast I'm going, my pace, my heart rate, where I am, how many miles I've done. It tracks. If I wear it during the day, I take it off when I practice just because I don't like to have it on my wrist. But like, it'll tell me my steps. It will tell me my stress levels. I don't know if it's accurate or not for that, you know. But
stress levels.
Yeah. It usually says.
Is that based on your blood pressure?
Yeah. I think so. I think it's based on your heart rate variability, on your level of fitness, on like a bunch of things. But I mean, I mostly just use it for working out and for running. But it's very helpful if I'm trying to hit a certain pace to see how fast I need to go to get there or if I need to slow down. It has a bunch of running metrics, but I mean, there's so many. I mean, like the only thing you really need is the GPS. But I mean, I love it. I feel very weird when I run without it because I'm definitely very reliant on it.
Well, yeah. I mean, I just use my phone and I have like.
Yeah, that's great too.
What's the running app? I can't remember.
Yeah, there's Strava. There's a bunch of different ones.
Yeah. So here's another part of my question with the training, which I personally am like very amateur about this. I don't really keep track of my mile times. So how do you pace if you're doing 6 miles? Mm-hmm. How do you normally try to pace each mile? Like you want to start slow and then like kind of at what point do you start pushing yourself to speed up?
Okay, so it depends on the workout that I'm doing. If I'm doing, you know, just an easy run, just trying to get mileage, I'll probably try and hit like 9-minute miles. Pretty easy, like not terribly fast.
Relaxed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then if I'm doing like a long run, I'm like, say my goal pace for the race is like 7:30 or something. I'll probably do like try and hit 8:15 for my long run pace. But like only if it feels comfortable. Like I don't want it to feel hard. So a lot of it's based on effort and like how it feels. And then if I'm doing a workout, say I'm gonna do like a warm-up and then I'm gonna do like 400-meter or like quarter mile sprints or something. Then I know for those short intervals, like I really want to push myself. And then I can like do like a recovery jog, you know, until I do the next one. So, I mean, there's a ton of different workouts in running that you can do. I love to do treadmill classes, which is kind of fun. I do like the Peloton ones. But yeah, it depends on the workout. If I'm doing something for speed, like say I want to do like 2 miles at my race pace, like I want to do 2 miles at like 6:30, then I'm going to like know that entire 2 mile stretch of the run, I'm going to be working really hard, but I'm not going to do 6 miles. Like I'm not going to do my entire run like that. So it's like a mixture of, you know, when you're working really hard and then working kind of easy and hard.
Yeah. So I guess that's kind of my question is like, what is the overall, like if you were to put it on a graph or something like that, like what would your overall shape be? Is it more spiky and in that kind of way? Or is it a little bit more of a smoother curve or a dome shape or something?
Yeah. I think just so like, it just kind of, I think it depends, but definitely would be like a small kind of slope as you're warming up. And then you'd probably have like a hard effort, kind of spiky. And depending on like if you're doing intervals or something, then it'd be like hard effort.
Yeah.
Relaxed down to baseline, hard effort. Down to baseline, and then your cool down is going to be like the other way, going kind of like a slight slope down,
right? The bell,
but it just depends. I mean, like, you know, if I'm just doing an easy run, it's kind of just straight, and then it kind of just gradually gets harder. And then I'm like, okay, I'm tired, I'm gonna stop.
Yeah, okay. I know that it might seem a little pedantic to like think about visually these things, but for me, it's honestly helpful because, again, as an amateur runner, like my goal is just like, okay, run now, like, you know, and like just keep your pace and like the whole time rather than actually try to plan. So, I remembered another app I use is the Nike Run app.
Oh, yeah.
Which I really like, actually, because you can choose runs with a coach that talks to you as you're going through, which helps me remind myself to pace myself or like to really work on hitting your stride right when you're really supposed to and warming up correctly and cooling down correctly too. Yeah. So I feel like maybe it's just my own experience in PE class back in high school where, you know, it's just a cattle call, like, okay, just run around the track. Like nothing was taught to me about how you should prepare. And like the competitive side was just like, oh, did I beat this person today or not? Like, you know, in your class or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's definitely true. And also like, I think it's good to do like a, you know, dynamic warm up, some stretching, like not static stretching, but like a dynamic stretching. And also like I do some like muscle activation and just to get my like muscles and joints ready to like have that pounding on the pavement kind of. And just like some, they're called like prehab, you know, it's like preventative exercises to like, you know, just get things ready before you run too. So I think, I think that's very true. It's like most people when they start running, they just think it's like, okay, tie your shoes, go out the door, run as hard as you can until you like feel like you're dying and then stop.
Yeah.
And it doesn't need to be why I feel like those are the least enjoyable kind of runs. Like the best ones are when you can just kind of relax, enjoy the scenery, you know, just kind of like take your time. And then, mm-hmm. you know, when you want to go really hard and like try and get a fast mile or fast race or whatever, then that's when you push yourself. But like not every run has to be like that. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I think that's where a lot of people say they hate running mm-hmm. is because Definitely. They do those first versions of those runs. And it's, I'll tell this one small story and maybe you can relate with it too. I was running in undergrad at USC. There's this track that people just run around, you know, and I wasn't intentionally trying to do this, but I somehow paced myself so well this particular run that I ended up running for about an hour around this track, just like constant. I even like picked up a phone call in the middle of it. Like, I don't know, but I got into this huge euphoric state of runner's high that I've never really quite gotten to since then. Mm-hmm. But the consequent funny thing that happened the next day is like, okay, so I did this giant run. I don't even know how many miles I ran. And I like went to bed and I was sleeping in, you know, like a bunk situation, right? So the next morning I usually jump out of bed, but when I jumped out of bed, my legs just buckled from underneath me. Because I hadn't done any of the proper warm up or like stretching or whatever. I just did the like, and so I almost like fell on my face because I couldn't support my body. So I guess me bringing up this kind of funny story in retrospect is like, did you ever have any of those kinds of experiences? Or like, do you always get into like a runner's high? Or
I don't know. I feel like very rarely, like maybe if I run super fast or like I run like my best race or something, then I just like feel like yeah. so proud and like excited and like I got it, I did my goal. Like, I mean, I generally feel good at the end of a run because I'm like, all right, it's done, I did it. But I don't know that I necessarily feel the runner's high that often. I think it has to be like a very special day, and I don't even know what causes it. I don't know if it's yeah. like really pushing myself more or just random things. I mean, I've definitely had my share of like learning, oh, like I need to stretch, I need to, you know, do these warm-ups, I need to not try and run my hardest for like too long, you know, because that's not good and how you get injured and stuff. But I mean, rarely am I like, wow, this was like the worst idea I ever had, like why am I doing this? Like, especially, I mean, maybe yeah. during the run I might think that, like, oh, but then at the end the yeah. end I'm like, oh, this is great, like I'm gonna do it again tomorrow.
Totally. Yeah.
So yeah, but I don't know that okay. I don't think I really experience like a high that often.
So I mean, so it's not necessarily something that you have to like attain or like you're trying to get. It's just like if it happens, it's just extra motivation to keep going, kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely times when I'm like, especially maybe it's the first like couple of miles, I'm just like, you know, my feet feel kind of heavy, I'm slogging along, whatever.
Yeah.
And then maybe at mile four or something, I'll randomly just get a second wind and it just like feels so much easier. So I think there's yeah. times that that happens too. And then there's definitely times when it's just like the entire thing just sucks and you're like, this sucks. Is
yeah.
terrible.
Yeah.
But that yeah. doesn't mean that they're like, you're never going to have always bad runs or always good runs. There's going to be like a lot in between, kind of like with anything, like with practicing or performing,
yeah.
you know, like
yeah, can be perfect all the time.
Exactly.
Yeah. What about shoes? So that's actually, I'll just chime. Cause again, I mean, here I am the amateur here, but like I recently discovered that it's incredibly important what shoes you wear.
Yes.
Cause again, I had some like old sneakers that I was like, I mean, they're you know, whatever, Nike or whatever, but like they were running shoes, but they're old and I would the next day just like start, my shins would just get really sore. My calves would get really sore. And then one of my friends, Evo, told me like, you should just get, you know, new shoes, different like shoes. Get really good shoes. Like, yeah. And since buying those shoes, I never get sore after running like I did when I was. So yeah, I guess like, what's your experience? Or like, I don't know if you need to like drop any brand names or whatever, but like, do you have like a week supply of shoes or like, how does that work?
No, I don't have that many. I currently am running in like the Brooks Ghost line. It's like so personal what kind of shoe you like. I think like if you can go to a store, like I don't know if they have like Feet Fleets where you are, but any like running store, I'm sure like most places have like a running store, you know, where you can go and like talk to someone who knows what they're talking about. They can see what kind of like arches you have, if you have any, you know, like imbalances in your ankles, or maybe you have your feet go at a weird angle, or you know, and they can recommend like if you want more cushion, more stability, more, if you want like a more neutral shoe or a trail shoe or a racing flat or something. I don't know, like I have friends who like have like their special racing shoes, which are like, you know, really lightweight and like they're supposed to help you run fast, and they only use them on their yeah. race days. Like I only have one pair of shoes that I use. I mean, I replace it every 6 months. Like they're expensive, but
yeah,
like you, when yeah. when I start to like feel my shins or my calves getting really sore, and like they say every shoe like has about 300 to 500 miles, I think, and it's like yeah. lifespan, and then after that, you know, you're kind of just, you don't have any more cushion left for your running. And I mean, yeah. I don't know, I'm definitely not an expert in this for sure. I mean, there's tons of different options out there. There's like people that run barefoot. Yeah. There's, you know, minimalist shoes. I have to say that the minimalist shoes did not work for me. I was running one time in these like Nike Zeros, I think they were called. And that's like when I got a stress fracture because they just didn't have any cushion. But I have particularly high arches. And so like for some people, maybe that's great. Yeah. But like any running store will be able to help you. And like they can tell you if you need like insoles or anything. Because I also like use insoles to support my arch so that I don't put all that pressure on my shins. But I think it's just figuring out what works for you and what works well with your body and like someone who knows what they're talking about and can like help you in like a personalized fashion, I think is the best option for sure.
What do you end up doing with the shoes that you kind of wear out?
Some of them I keep just for like walking, and then a lot of times I'll donate them. A lot of running stores will have donation bins.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and you can take them and they'll give them to people.
A second life.
Yeah. You know, that just like want a pair of shoes. Because a lot of times like they are still in good condition. It's just like you want a little extra support when you're going to be doing long mileage. Or, you know, you can take them like a Goodwill, or, you know, there's no point in them like sitting in the closet. So.
Yeah. I mean, and also like, as you say, like they're totally perfectly fine walking shoes.
Exactly.
They're just running is a higher impact. Yeah.
Right.
And I was surprised when I bought, I think mine are like Nike Pegasus or whatever. But I was surprised when I bought those that I did feel like the shoe was making me propel faster and forward versus my other like cheaper versions that I got from like Nordstrom Rack or something, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that shocked me to like realize that there's like technology that is actually helping or aiding in the like propelling yourself forward in running.
Yeah. I think it's definitely cool. I mean, I don't know a lot about the specifics, but yeah, every brand has their own special thing that they say, whether it's a gel or like a spring or a bounce or some kind of like new compound that they've created that's going to make you faster. Like everyone always wants to be faster. So
yeah, of course.
Yeah. There's, I mean, I've very rarely have like run in really, really fast shoes, but yeah, I think that's really an interesting thing to think about too.
Yeah. Well, and to me, it reminds me a little, or I feel there's a connection with if you play on a cheaper student instrument and how hard it is to get a good sound out of it, you have to work that much harder versus like getting a really fantastic instrument, like a professional instrument and how easy it is to produce a sound. And that's how I felt when I put these shoes on. Like, I was just like, oh, wow, like this is so much easier. Yeah. Like, what was I doing before? Do you have any races that you're looking forward to?
I don't have any right now. I'm probably going to start looking and pick out some 5Ks and 10Ks for the spring. And then I'll probably do a half marathon again in like August or September.
Sure. So you're like in the midst of kind of, you're looking for races to motivate yourself, but like at the same time, you're kind of like training for the big half marathon.
Yeah. I mean, for now, I just kind of do like more maintenance of fitness. So I'm just doing a lot of like kind of slow miles, and I'm just like now starting to do some more like faster workouts. And then once I have a specific race date, then I can kind of like tailor it like a performance, you know, you can kind of like figure out what you want to get, how fast you want to get before that day. But yeah, I mean, it's all about like the cycles, you know, training cycles. Like you can't always be training super hard all the time or you'll get injured or burnt out.
Yeah.
Just like with performing, you have to take time to like recoup and let your body recover and just relax and
regenerate. Yeah. Cause you're like building muscle. So like you're breaking down some muscle that needs to rebuild itself to make it stronger. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's where like strength training and yoga is like really helpful too. Cause the more you can like be flexible, the stronger you can be, the less like strain it puts on your body. And then you can improve like a elastic rubber band almost. Like if you have better elasticity and stuff, then when you run, it's just a natural spring versus like a heavy down motion.
Sure. Like a bow. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Are there any last thoughts that or questions I forgot to ask you that you wanted to share with us about running?
The only thing I would say is I think that there is a big stigma, like you were saying, like in order to be a runner, you have to run fast, you have to run far. And I think that running is like one of the only sports that truly is for everyone. You can walk as much as you want. You can jog, you can run, you can run slow or fast or whatever. As long as you're moving, like you are considered a runner. So
yeah.
I think that, you know, that's people can be very intimidated by, you know, they see the super fast people out and about, and it doesn't need to be an exclusive thing. I think it's running is a very inclusive sport. I think everyone should try it out just once for sure. Because I think if you can find something, a way to move that just like feels good for you, it can be really great for stress relief. I use it all the time, like leading up to performance. Sometimes I can like do some mental practice while I'm running. And I think it's just really nice.
If I can tag on just a hair with that, other than buying proper shoes and maybe like some exercise leggings or whatever like that, it is also a relatively inexpensive sport, right? I mean,
yes.
It's just your body. Yeah. That's what I think attracts me to the sport, is that it's self-generating. Like, I don't need to, I mean, maybe I drive to a track, but I'm my own machine.
Right. Yeah. You don't need any super expensive equipment.
Yeah. So it is very approachable in that way. Well, thanks for sharing those thoughts. And I'm excited to see you out and about running and following your journey
thank you.
Can I ask you two final questions? Mm-hmm. What is one piece of advice you would tell your younger self about entering and pursuing a music career?
I would tell myself, never give up on your dreams. Mm-hmm. Always shoot for the stars and think big, because if you feel super comfortable with what you're doing, it's probably you're not pushing yourself hard enough or far enough in that direction that you should be going. And the other thing is, don't let what other people say get to you or bring you down. Because the opinion that really matters is your opinion of yourself. And I mean, yes, obviously teachers and colleagues, like, their opinions are very valid. I'm not saying that at all. Mm-hmm. But I think that sometimes we can get too in our heads. We can get too self-conscious about one little thing that maybe someone else would never notice. And that if you are proud of who you are and the work that you're doing and the way that you are going about things, like, eventually you will be successful and you'll be happy with the way that you got there.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. But I do think that there's a journey to find that balance too. I mean, because essentially that comes down to self-confidence and, like, definitely, really believing in yourself. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, like, personally, I'll speak for myself that there's times where I wish that I could have gotten to that point sooner. But, you know, there's definitely, I let some of the haters hate a little bit too much, or I, like, became self-critical too much or whatever. But yeah, like, part of that self-confidence, or building that self-confidence, is also keeping things in perspective. Because yes, I think the definitely more we narrow in, yeah, as, like, musicians, if we're just worried about one note articulation or something like that, that's, like, easy blinders to then, like, preventing us to see the bigger picture of what's going on. But yeah, I think overall that's, like, great advice. Thanks for that. And my second question, as we enter an ever-evolving, changing post-pandemic world, what elements of your musical pandemic life would you want to continue, and what would you want to shed?
Honestly, if I didn't have to do a Zoom concert ever again, that would be great. You know, I would love to keep all of the new connections and friends and social media and just opportunities that have arisen. There's definitely been a lot of negative things with COVID, but I think there's a lot of change and a lot of progress that's been made as well during this short time that we've been in this situation, which mm-hmm. I think, you know, we shouldn't just cast aside once things are hopefully moving back towards what we would consider to be the normal. So, you know, having access to concerts, like, that are streamed, I think is great. And, you know, getting to meet people from all over the world, it's great. I mean, so things like that, you know, I don't think that we should get rid of that kind of stuff and those connections that we have.
Yeah, totally. Are there any platforms or websites for listeners to learn more about you or any upcoming projects?
Yeah, probably the best one that I usually update is going to be on my Instagram at girl.meets.cello. I also have a website, www.catherineottis.com. I do have a YouTube channel that I occasionally post performances on. Yeah, and feel free to DM me or write me with any questions that you might have. I'd love to hear from you. And yeah, I think that would be the best way to get in touch. Keep an eye out on my page, as well as I'm going to be working on the social media for this new nonprofit, Classical Karma, where you'll be able to watch all of our concerts for free online. And if you feel inclined, you know, donate to the causes that we're working with, but mostly just enjoy the music.
All right. And if you enjoyed listening, be sure to smash that subscribe button wherever you're tuning into this podcast. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts while you're at it. It doesn't need to be long. Your review will help others search for the podcast because of its crazy algorithms, and you'll make Sushi's day. And it's free. Make sure to share this podcast with your friends and family as well. If you want to level up, you can always become part of the Haydn Behind the Music Stand family by donating what you will on our Patreon page at patreon.com/Haydn Music Stand. Our social media handle for Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter is @HaydnMusicStand, and we'd love to hear from you at our email, HaydnMusicStand@gmail.com. Didn't recognize the piece we discussed during the episode? No worries. There's a Spotify playlist with all the music discussed for your convenience. The link is in the description of each episode. Thank you so much, Catherine, for being on the show today. It's always such a pleasure to share thoughts together, and I look forward to all the content to come on your Instagram page, and I hope that we'll run into each other sometime soon.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me, Patty, and, like, I love your podcast. I'm so excited to be sharing a few of my thoughts with your lovely listeners. And it's just been such a blast hanging out, and hopefully we get to perform together and hang out soon.
Yeah, let's do it. Okay. And thank you for listening. Say bye, Sushi.
Oh, I think a kazoo sounds kind of fun.
Okay. Do I have to do Sinfonia Concertante now? On okay, here we go.
I would pay for that.
Wait, how does it go again?
That's pretty good. Da da da
da da da da da. Da. Oh, okay, let me try again. Let me try. Wait, I always get like lost. Wait, because I'm thinking. Wait, I just should I get the music out? Wait, oh wait, da 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 da. Right, three beats,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, okay. Third time's the charm. Oh damn it! Da, da, da. I know it how it sounds without the kazoo, but for whatever reason, I can't do it with the kazoo. Oh, I'm a failure as a cellist. Wow, that took way too much effort in my brain.
That was very entertaining. I enjoyed it.
Okay, I'm glad.